blue lights on. Good morning. This is the Education Subcommittee of Ways and Means, and it is May the 26th, and it is not Monday, it is Tuesday. And welcome to everybody. We are here today to talk about TSPC, open a public hearing on House Bill 2411, and on the budget bill, which is Senate Bill 5538. Doug.
Mr. Chair, as Ms. Chamberlain comes to the dais, I think she would like to start off with House Bill 2411, which is at the back end of the presentation in your what's on your line. I think it's slide 40. This will give some context, and I think she also has at least one or two people here to for public testimony, so you will get through that, and then she'll return to the budget bill, which will be the beginning of the presentation. So I believe this is slide 40 of 47, and these, of course, two bills are combined or are very interrelated because the budget increases in the budget bill rely in large part on the passage of House Bill 2411 also.
Vicki, welcome.
Good morning, Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Comp, members of the committee. For the record, Vicki Chamberlain, the Director of Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. So thank you for putting our bills up for hearing here, and I will start here with House Bill 2411. There's three foci in the bill, and the first one is to refine our licensure system. This is actually fairly substantial in terms of how it will simplify other work in the office. So we would abolish current outdated licenses. We have two systems running. I'll get into that a little bit more here in a second. It also increases our statutory fee cap, which right now is at $100. Without the fee, we've been at the fee cap since 2005 for the last 10 years. And without an increase in the fee cap, we're unable to generate any new revenue. And then a proposed name change to align with other professional educator standards boards in the nation. The movement to one licensure system, I think, is the highest priority in this bill next to the fee cap. Right now, we have a system where licenses that were created in 1965 to 1999 are still active and current, basic and standard teaching licenses.
Oh,
I got my license in 1980. I have a license in that area, or had a license in that area. And then in 1999, the commission created a new licensure system, but they didn't abolish the old one, which turned out probably to be a fairly significant underestimation of what it would take to run two licensure systems side by side. So since 1999, the commission's been issuing an initial to the first licensed folks and a continuing to what's now considered the professional teaching license level. And the commission in July 2012 convened a redesign committee, which has been meeting continuously since then to look at redesigning the licensure system. There are over 20 stakeholders on that committee, and it has been extremely well attended.
And you got your license in 1980?
I did.
I got mine in 1965.
Oh. Did you get a basic or standard?
Basic, I think, and then I got my master's degree after that. So,
Chairman Rowe, members of the committee, we still have about 400 people who were licensed prior to 65 and who keep their licenses active. A few of them are employed still, so
substituting or something like that.
Well, if you look at it, the youngest person is probably about 71. If they got out when they're 21 or 22, 71 mm-hmm. or 72, they could still be working, depending. I know several of them have hung on to their licenses. The new system has names for our new proposed structure. Would be preliminary would go to the brand new teachers, and professional would go to the folks who had taught for a minimum amount of time and had done some professional work from the time they received their preliminary teaching license. Distinguished is actually distinguished teacher leader, and the work group had actually picked this name for it, and then the legislation was passed in 2013 to create a teacher leader license, and we've, I think, resolved all the issues on that now, which is exciting. We're creating a legacy teaching license for all the folks who received a basic teaching license back in the day, because they were told from year one they never would have to receive any additional education. And so in order to kind of springboard them into a continuously renewable license that would be clear, we created the legacy. Since the committee started looking at that, we have lost almost 1,000 teachers in that category. So we're down to about 62,000 people who, 6,200 people who have a basic teaching license still. 85% of our standard teaching licenses, which are about 13,000 people, are employed, which is very interesting. But the basic teaching license folks seem to be retiring at the highest rate of any group. The reciprocal teaching license is the new license that we would give to new out-of-state teachers. It'd be clearly identified as the reciprocity license, if you will, and the commission has the most generous reciprocity rules in the nation. We take the license as it comes in from the other state. We grant them the exact same license that they had in the other state. If they've taken tests in the other state, we accept those in lieu of our tests without retesting them. And generally, all they have to do is take the civil rights test, which is a statutory requirement. So the transition into Oregon is, I think, as painless as anywhere in the nation. So our initiatives in this area, get the little hand off of there, are to continue ahead. We've spent actually the last 3 years exclusively on the teaching license area. And we were going to pick up the administrator license system, except that the urgency behind really looking more closely at the current technical ed licenses is extremely high right now. So we flip-flopped the order and priority of those. And then redesigned the personnel service license, which is your school counselor, your school psychologist, and your school social worker license. That'll be our last phase. So I'm predicting we can get this work done in the next 2 years with the same kind of thoughtfulness in the same committee.
Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you. And sorry, I missed the beginning. I'm excited to hear about all the things you guys are doing. Can I have ask you a question about the preliminary license? Is there a timeline on that? Like when you first come in, that's what you get, and it lasts for X number of years, and then you move into the professional or distinguished category? Or is that, am I reading that wrong?
No. Co-chairs and Representative Smith-Warner. There is a timeline on it, it will work like this. If someone comes out brand new and gets their preliminary teaching license and they're employed, they have 6 years to move to the professional teaching license, which would be one renewal. What wasn't taken into account under the old systems and that we have to take into account is if they're not employed immediately, then what happens? So the commission has designed additional expectations after the first license is received, some coursework, which actually being proposed right now could be anywhere from undergrad in terms of learning a new language to any areas. And we're encouraging people toward dual credit and other things that align with initiatives. But in the event the person holding the preliminary teaching license doesn't obtain 4 full years of teaching, which we believe moves a novice to a professional level, they can continuously renew their preliminary teaching license with professional development as long as they'd like after they've completed their initial requirements to move to the professional. So the expectation will be you get your brand new license, you complete your additional work, whatever that is. It could be high quality professional development or undergrad work or graduate work, their choice. It'll be weighted. And then if they do not get the experience piece, they can continuously renew a professional development. That way they're not forced into having to drop their license or do something similar.
Senator Roblin.
I think Representative Huffman asked a question like this before, but Is the preliminary a bachelor's degree, or do you have to have a master's degree? I mean, that fifth year now that we use for almost everybody as a teacher is expensive, and I think the conversation was about could we start at a fourth year and then to get your professional move. I don't know the answer to that question, so I was wondering if we're doing anything different with the four-year degree.
Co-Chair Senator Roblin, the commission doesn't mandate how people exit programs. The universities select what kind of program they're going to have. Although I need to tell you historically that in 1989, VIRCATS actually came back and mandated that the public higher ed systems had to create MAT programs. The regional colleges did not have to abolish their undergrad programs. So most of our regional publics will have an MAT program and a small undergrad program. The private universities that prepare our teachers, there's 12 of them and six publics, to compete also created MAT programs or post-baccalaureate programs where somebody may get a fifth year but not have to get the master's. So about 65% of all new Oregon teachers come out with either a fifth year or an MAT. I know that George Fox right now is looking into resurrecting a more robust undergrad program, but most of our undergrad programs prepare elementary teachers, and our elementary teachers constitute about 45% of our brand new teachers every year. If you think about it, it's 8 grades out of 12, so right. That's not an unreasonable number. So the commission does not determine that it has to be a master's or an MAT or an undergrad. What we look at is that they're meeting all the same standards and that people, when they come out, get the same license or equally prepared to teach.
Representative Huffman.
Did you have a follow-up, Senator? Vicki, if you said it early on, I apologize, I missed it. Did you have a work group? Who was involved in this redesign work?
We have the COSA has two representatives on there. The school boards have a representative. OEA has representatives. We have public higher ed. We have private higher ed. We have current commissioners, former commissioners, teachers in the field, active administrators in the field. Chalkboard has a representative on there. And I think that covers the stakeholder groups.
So that's a pretty large group of people.
20. Co-chair,
my experience is that the bigger the committee, the harder it is for to come to any conclusion.
Senator Monroe, members of the committee, that committee has become very, very effective, interestingly, and then their recommendations have then gone to the commission for review and either acceptance or modification. But because we have met about every other month, we have a fascinatingly high percentage of attendance in that group. And so over the course of 3 years, they have, you know, sort of grown and understand licensure so well now, it has become a pretty effective work group. I will tell you, the first 6 meetings were throw something at the wall and see if it sticks. Kind of, well, until, you know, you get your processes and your facilitation and your sort of how you're going to work together in place. And since then, it's been one of the greatest professional experiences that I've had with such a big stakeholder group.
One of the real problems we have as we try to expand CTE programs is a shortage of people that are qualified to teach those kinds of programs, commercial, technical, and to prepare more students for those generally high-paying jobs. What are you looking at when you redesign CTE in terms of providing for an adequate supply of teachers in those that are actually qualified to teach in those technical areas?
Senator Monroe and members of the committee, I think what we're looking at is a model that makes sure that when people go into the classroom, they're prepared to do that, and lots of states have that. But The challenge is not huge, but it's a challenge, and that is for a couple of decades or longer, the only CTE licenses and programs we've had have been funded by federal Carl Perkins money, and the federal law required certain things in order to become a teacher, and among them was a local instructor appraisal committee. So in other words, if someone was coming in from the field, let's just take welding, and the school district wanted to do a program in metals or welding. The person would come in from industry, they'd meet with this instructor appraisal committee, and they would make them a professional development plan over the course of 3 years that says, you need to learn this in the teaching area, classroom management, let's say, and how some of the pedagogy, meaning how to teach it, types of things they wouldn't have coming in directly from the field. By the same token, if a teacher had perhaps somewhere picked up metal skills and wanted to do that, they would have to also meet with the instructor appraiser committee, and that group would tell them, well, you know, in the next 3 years, you need to go refresh or pick up X number of hours out in industry working on those skills. So those programs were funded by federal funds, and ODE and TSPC had a very tight partnership, and we did all the rules on that and have for the last 15, 20 years together, so that the school districts say, we're going to have a metals program. They went to ODE, they got it approved, they got federal money, and then we would license them, and that was based on these committees were set up and et cetera, et cetera. Then along came state funding for CTE areas, and we're not tied to the Perkins restrictions. The commission has had licenses for years that have fit, and we have given these out. People just weren't aware of it. So, for example, Portland has a high number of limited teaching licenses, which means the people who hold them have either a associate's degree, 2 years of community college, or equivalent. And then they can teach in their area. So the magnet schools in Portland have dance folks who get this limited teaching license in dance. It's renewable every 3 years. We get these, what I have seen, these portfolios of folks who've been engaged in dance for their whole career. They've choreographed, they've taught, and that actual 24 years of experience is substituted for the 2 years of college based on their experience. So we have the vehicles. The work is communicating to the field that the only structure for CTE is not the old Perkins instructor appraisal committee route. We did an analysis, and I'm sorry I don't have it, but I will get it to you. But we have firefighting first responder licenses out there, dance licenses out there, welding licenses out there, engineer. In other words, for school districts who are just teaching a small piece of a program. And what I have seen in terms of the bills that have come up is, I think, a desire for a little bit more structure in terms of the preparation that people from industry get to work in the classroom, and also a commitment for teachers right now who may want to teach in the CTE area, who teach in the general education area, also have an expectation to refresh their skills out in industry. So looking at that with a broader lens is the work that we have to do over the biennium. And communicating to the field that right now people can get a license for things that they want to do in the CTE areas that are funded with state funds.
Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Senator Monroe. For the reciprocal, about how many folks come from out of state? How many do we grant licenses to approximately?
Actually, that number's up. So generally, it's about 1,700 to 2,000 a year.
Follow up?
Go ahead.
They get the license, and most of those, I assume, go and get jobs?
Co-chairs and Representative Taylor, I don't have the employment numbers, but most folks come up and get the license because it's very hard to get a job without the license.
Yeah.
And but I will tell you that our numbers of state folks are up significantly, mm-hmm. actually. We took a dip during the recession when mm-hmm. people weren't moving. Mm-hmm. At one point, about 10 years ago, about 15% of our new teachers were coming in from out of state. And so what I'm seeing is I saw this, we took a dip, and now I see an increase again because without a sales tax and other things, Oregon's a pretty desirable place to live.
Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Chairman Rowe. So can you tell me a little bit about the logic? You said we have some of the most lenient of, you know, allowing folks to come here and we grant them a license. Why we don't have them take our exam? I mean, are we at risk of teachers who perhaps didn't fare well wherever they came from coming here, or perhaps they went to school a long time ago and out of date? Can you talk to me a little bit about why do we do that? Why don't we?
Co-chairs, Representative Taylor, I wouldn't characterize it, I don't think, as lenient as weighing why you would have someone do something. So every state in the nation has a set of minimum standards to get a license. Mm-hmm. So we check to see that the program was approved by the state, and give pretty much reciprocity and quality to that license. So there are only two testing companies in the nation. Mm. And you look at their tests that states have adopted and hold them up side by side, there is not a significant difference between California's chemistry test and Washington's chemistry test and Oregon's chemistry test. It becomes an exercise of pretty nuanced differences between the tests because there's only two testing companies. So requiring people to take that subject matter test really is a matter of perhaps California had a few points less or a few points more. But it doesn't take into account the fact that those tests are for very beginning teachers, and that we would often get veterans who taught for 20 years or are coming in and being asked to retake a test that they had already taken in another state or similar test and then had taught for 20 years. They have to have the full degree. They have to have completed teacher prep from an accredited institution, and then we accept the tests. If they want to add an endorsement in Oregon, they have to do it like all other teachers. They have to take the test in a new area. So I think it's just saying that fundamentally, most institutions and states have the same or similar accreditation standards. And somebody could come in without having taught for a number of years, and the market tends to take care of that. Although I will tell you, under our new system, we are requiring people who haven't taught for a number of years to do some actually refresher work when they come into the state, as well as if they've let their license lapse and want to come back into the field.
Thank you. Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Vicki, what's the current requirement in early learning for anything from preschool to Head Start, including OPK? What are the teaching requirements? Is there 2-year certification? Limited license?
Co-chairs, Representative Huffman, currently there are no requirements for that. The commission's jurisdiction runs from kindergarten through grade 12. And early conversations we've had with the early childhood folks are that they wanted to kind of get their feet on the ground, get their standards set before any of those issues are looked at. So any licensure for pre-K is optional or voluntary publicly, but right now the commission doesn't license in that area.
Follow up.
Go ahead.
Thank you. So the troubling effort that I'm hearing about this session to begin requiring a regular baccalaureate type of a teaching certificate is coming out of early learning and not as a part of any licensure redesign conversation?
Co-chairs, Representative Huffman, there have been no conversations at the commission level about early childhood licensure, primarily, like I said, because our jurisdiction starts in kindergarten. And so any conversations about that are being generated in the early learning environment.
Thanks.
And Representative Huffman, if you require preschool teachers to have some kind of a license or degree, you might have to pay them a living wage.
That's true.
One of my concerns.
Just moving on quickly to show you how what we believe, not we believe, we have created a true tiered system where you have to rise through the tiers, where the third tier is optional. So the terms on the license will look like this: the preliminary 3 years, the professional 5 years, the distinguished teacher leader 5 years. And the distinguished teacher leader is optional. This is for people who have distinguished themselves on practice-based things and leadership, mentoring, supervising student teachers, some other above and beyond contributions. And should they choose not to continue in those activities, then they can keep their professional teaching license and continuously renew it with professional development. The new system will also simplify endorsements. We have at least 80 endorsements on our regular teaching licenses. This doesn't include the American Indian language that have unique languages, or the limiteds where I was telling you had like electrician or cosmetology or dance. This is just our sort of what you consider your general curriculum. So it would simplify it from 80 down to 38, which is very exciting because we have an endorsement system for the old licenses and an endorsement system for the new licenses. And then just quickly, as I mentioned, the reciprocal teaching license goes to out-of-staters. They'd have 1 year to meet their requirements to move to the new license. And then the folks moving to the legacy. The recommendation is if a veteran teacher comes in from out of state and they were licensed prior to 1999, they have the choice to move to the legacy. If they move into the other system, then they have to meet the same expectations as everybody else. But
Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just trying to get a sense. So on the out of state, that's a 1 year, that reciprocal teaching license. Is that what you just said?
Co-chairs Representative Smith Warner. That's the proposal right now.
Okay.
Yes.
And then on the legacy, I had been thinking about this when you talked about it earlier. So those folks, if they're in state and they got it before a certain point, they could maintain that. And the significant difference is you do not have to have the continuing education with the legacy that you have to have in the professional or the distinguished. Is that correct?
So, co-chairs Representative Smith Warner, I think the correct. You don't have to have any coursework post initial licensure to be on the legacy. If somebody wants to obtain the other license, say the preliminary and the professional, then they would have to meet the same expectations as everybody else. But the folks who are on the legacy, prior to between 1965 and 1999, there were no additional coursework requirements for everybody. Everybody, however, on a teaching license in Oregon right now who isn't meeting additional coursework requirements, it has to have continuing professional development to renew. So it's not like doing nothing and then being able to renew.
So a legacy then would be doing some level of continuing education?
Yes.
Even though they were a legacy, they had a legacy and not?
Correct.
And what's the time proposal for the legacy? Is that five like the other
It's
two?
Been a three-year license. The basic has been a three-year license. The commission hasn't taken that into consideration. Moving any group to a longer license does have a long-term cash flow impact on the agency, as opposed to if you're renewing for 3 years or you're renewing every 5 years, it would have. But right now, any license right now that we envision going on to that is currently a three-year renewable license, and I think the proposed is to have it be a three-year license. And this is a good place to add that we really can't adopt these rules and adopt the system without this bill, because this bill repeals those other licenses, and those other licenses are pretty statutorily detailed about what we have to do by law. So until we can get rid of the basic and the standard and the initial and the continuing to go to our preliminary and professional and our teacher leader, we can't create these licenses and start doing this.
Senator Roblin.
Yeah, outside of the licenses, there's also, if you're a sub, there's a substitute license. And I know that the changes there have created hardship in a lot of rural areas because many of the subs were retired teachers who no longer want to do that, so they just lost all their substitute lists. Is there anything to do with that? I mean, I was shocked to find out that most retiring teachers don't do subbing anymore because the requirements for getting a sub license have expanded, and they're not willing to do that. Is there? Am I hearing the wrong thing, or what's going on?
Co-Chair Senator Roblin, I think you're hearing some of the right thing.
Okay, that's
all right. And the commission said that actually reduces requirements for people on substitute licenses where they only have to get 10 hours per year of continuing professional development. That's like an 8-hour workshop and 2 hours or one, and it's a 3-year license. So it's 30 hours over the course of 3 years. The belief is that they need to be current in the field as much as anybody else. Whoa. And so that's the correct piece. We're not actually seeing that play out in the numbers in terms of reducing people signing up in actuality. And in fact, old licenses reinstatements are up almost double from the previous biennium. So there may be a few people who say they don't want to do that, and we have heard that, but we can't universally prove it to be true. What was, I think, a problem and is a problem is the ability to get a substitute who isn't a complete, fully trained teacher. So if there are some states who say no one can substitute unless they're completely trained as a teacher. Oregon allows people with a bachelor's degree and district sponsorship to become a restricted substitute. And when we were so oversupplied, which hasn't been that long ago, I would say prior to the previous 5 years, the commission had limited the number of days somebody on a restricted sub could work in a district in a calendar year, in a school year, to 60 days. That actually has been an area that the commission just very recently took some very major steps. And what we have done is said that there's no limit on the number of days that restricted substitutes can substitute. And it doesn't matter if it's rural or Portland. We have a substitute crisis across the state. So what we're seeing are education service districts who are banding together to share substitutes, who are providing free professional development for the substitutes, and there's coalitions forming all over the state to do this. So I don't see professional development being a barrier. Getting the bodies available, I think, is the biggest challenge. So the commission has removed as many obstacles as they can for rural and other folks to get substitutes into the classroom.
Good. Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Chairman Rowe. So for the legacy teaching positions, do we have any incentives in place in order to get the legacy teachers to want to move to the professional degree? Is there an opportunity to earn more money or something, or is there some sort of incentive in place?
Co-chairs, Representative Taylor, sorry. I was answering the question in my head. The commission doesn't have anything to do with what happens once people are employed. So any incentives to obtain a license have to happen at the district level. There aren't any state stipends. You know, there isn't anything to entice anybody into national boards. The thing is that people can, with additional coursework, can opt into a professional. If they haven't obtained any additional coursework, we're giving them the legacy teaching license. So I did get additional coursework, although I never moved to the standard. We don't know how many folks did that. I stepped out of the profession, and so I could just say, I would like a professional teaching license. They will evaluate it and put them straight into professional. So all we're doing is saying that we actually have people who've held this license since 65 who were told they never had to do additional coursework who may or may not be working. We didn't want to force them into professional, but many of them are going to want to have it anyway. So that won't trickle out until we've rotated all the way through the renewals, because this is how implementation will have to work. It won't just spring up on the day we implement. As people renew, we'll move them on to the new licenses. So the incentive is the current salary schedules in districts. So it's highly unlikely that there's a whole lot of these folks who have done absolutely nothing. They would have chosen to stay on this first introductory salary column and not move up. And so I think the likelihood of a whole of this being populated by thousands of people are pretty small. In fact, I would be surprised if it's greater than 3,000.
I promise, last question,
yeah.
Chairman Rowe.
We are going to have to move along.
Okay, last, I guess I just can't. Maybe I'm misunderstanding something, but I see, regardless of it going through TSPC or not, I see a potential problem down the road, building off what Representative Huffman and perhaps Senator Roblin were saying, is that we're going to increase the requirements for pre-K. Someone is, I mean, not you, but in the state, we'll say, okay, you have to get, you know, a bachelor's and maybe even a master's pre-K, but then yet we have some leniency with this other group of teachers who've been teachers for a long time. I'm just concerned that we're going to have these inconsistencies across the board. It seems that to teach a three or four-year-old that maybe having a two-year degree would be, not that that's your responsibility, would be sufficient, but yet we would want to have our legacy teachers well prepared as we would want any professional dealing with the public. But that's more of a comment. You don't have to respond to that. But
yeah.
Anyways, moving forward.
If you don't mind, yeah. I'd like to respond. All these folks have at least a bachelor's. Some of them may have a master's. Some of them, you know, we don't know why they didn't advance to a standard teaching license.
Okay.
So I don't want you to think they were prepared any differently than other folks who chose to do a coursework after they were initially licensed.
Okay.
Oh, so it was a good time anyway. It won't advance. Will it click? No, click. Oh, there it is. So it's just a summary page, and I am actually done with the licensure piece. And did you want to do testimony before the other bill? Great. Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mason. From OEA. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good morning, Co-Chairs Monroe, Co-Chair Comp, members of the committee. Jared Mason here representing the Oregon Education Association and roughly 42,000 educators across the state. Here to offer our support for House Bill 2411 and thank Director Chamberlain and her staff for being very responsive to a number of concerns that we did raise with the bill as it was introduced, the changes to which are reflected in the House amendments and the engrossed bill. We support the streamlining effort. I think that the most important thing for you probably to hear from us today, though, is that we also support the fee increase that's included in House Bill 2411. Obviously, our members were not just lining up out of the gates for no reason to pay more for their licenses, but they do see that there will be a very dramatic and positive impact on the TSBC, and thus improved responsiveness to their concerns, their licensure applications, and disciplinary proceedings. TSBC processes roughly 21,000 licenses per year, addresses approximately 300 disciplinary proceedings per year, all on a very bare-bones staff, which then leads to some delays and other hardships for our members. So we do believe that by chipping in a small amount per application, that our members will then see a dramatic increase in responsiveness and an overall benefit. Sort of an interesting anecdote. I was at a friend's barbecue over the weekend and just happened to meet somebody who is a new school counselor here in Oregon. And automatically I was kind of talking about what I do for work and said, oh, do you work with the TSBC? And just as I had planned my Memorial Day with drinking a few beers, having some barbecue, and talking at length about the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, we did end up having a lengthy conversation, and he was talking about some of the frustrations that he's experienced trying to go through the new application process, long wait times on the phones. And he wasn't angry with TSBC. He was actually very sympathetic. He was talking about talking with people who he can tell are overworked, who are very stressed out, and they're trying very hard to do a good job under very difficult circumstances. And he was very eager to see us take some steps to improve circumstances there, which we believe that we will do if we can increase the statutory fee cap and add a small $40 amount to the fee. So I urge your support, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Mason. Other questions? Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jared, are your members confident that the systems are in place with the commission to make the necessary improvements? Paying an additional fee and hoping for better service is one thing, but are the systems in place and have they been described to your members as to how things will improve, or is it a lick and a promise and a hope? Sorry, Vicki. But.
Yeah, Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Comp, Representative Huffman. I think, and I certainly understand the question. I think we have the expectation that the systematic changes that are included in House Bill 2411 will combine with the fee increase to make some market improvements. Certainly understand that there are some concerns. I think the combination of the communication that has existed to our members and the expectation of increased communication to our members through the duration of this process give us both hope and confidence.
Okay. Thank you very much. We appreciate your input.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Wilson, where do we go now?
Mr. Chair, members, we return back to the beginning of the presentation document, so page one or page zero, whatever it works out to be, to talk about the budget that the fees will be used for, the fee increases. Just a reminder, House Bill 2411, which you just heard, the fee bill, raises the statutory cap from $100 to $350 as it's currently drafted. That does not mean that there's going to be a jump in the fees from 100 to 350. It allows them in the future to increase fees to that amount. The amount that the basic amount or basic teacher license that they're proposing as part of their budget process will increase from $100 to $140. And I'm sure Vicki will go through that again. So back to the beginning of the presentation document.
Co-chairs, member of the committee, for the record, Vicki Chamberlain, Director of Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, and providing information on Senate Bill 5538, our budget bill, different than you heard from us in February. So I'm going to talk about our revenue history a little bit more detailed than we did in February, our current revenue and expenditure situation, as well as customer service improvements we've been able to accomplish, which address Representative Huffman's concerns directly since February, and then our policy option packages. I think the story we want to tell here is how difficult it often is to predict our revenues and how dependent our revenues and actions on licensure is upon school funding and other things that happen in the system. So if you'll look between 2005 and 2007, the commission took an unexpected 2003 to 2005, $1.5 million jump in one biennium. That was because that was the biennium that we had our fee increase. So we came out of the 2005 session with a fee increase from $75 to $100, and it had that significant bump up of increase. If you look, our expenditures were $4.1 million, and as you can see, created a fairly significant ending fund balance, which has kept the commission in the black over the course of this really kind of trying time. So in 2007, following that fee increase, our revenues increased about 7%. And then between 2007 and 2009, it only increased about 1%. So 0.1% at C, it's almost flat. It's actually reduced slightly. And then in 2011-13, we took a 10% drop in one biennium. And the thing that is important to notice here is that we had projected that our actual revenue in 2011-13 would be just about the 2009-2011, and we took in about $500,000 less over the course of the biennium, which is fairly significant in a tiny budget like we have. So the other thing I want to explain to you is trying to pick up on the drop that was happening in 2011-2013 was fairly difficult. So just by budget production deadlines, we had to do our first revenue estimate in February of 2012. So that's a bare 6 months of history that we have in revenue that we have to project our next revenue projections. And we could see there was a decline in revenue coming, and it was actually starting to look fairly significant. We didn't get a really great idea that things were dropping dramatically until about March, April of 2012. And so by May 2012, we were $480,000 down in terms of our projections for the entire biennium. We knew the writing was on the wall 8 months into the biennium. That isn't a lot of time to act or react. So our budget was approved, if you'll see approved expenditures in 2011-2013, at $5.5 million. So the legislature, we believed when we turned our budget in that we would get about $5.1 million like we had the two previous biennia. The legislature gave us permission to spend into that ending fund balance so we could catch up on investigations and actually catch up licensure. And we did get caught up. 2 years ago, we were completely caught up. There were no backlogs. However, had we spent to our limitation, we would have taken our ending fund balance down below the three-month limit. So we scrambled. All of our cuts happened in after one full year into the biennium in order to get savings. And I think that, as you'll see, we were able to reduce our expected expenditures by $600,000, and then which took us $300,000 into our ending balance. But it was dramatic. When we cut in July, we cut three positions, including a management position. I had terminated a manager during the winter of 2012. We didn't fill that position. We terminated another position. We didn't fill that position. And then we laid off again in October. So between not filling vacancies and layoffs and terminations, we reduced our staffing by eight positions between July 2013 and 2014. So that between July 2012 and 2013, that last part of the biennium. So when we came to do our budget 2 years ago, like I said, we were caught up. But it really did take its toll, the reduced staffing. Plus, we were, as you can see, our I don't have our approved revenue. Our approved revenue for this biennium was $4.6 million. And right now it's projecting that we're going to come in about $4.9 million, which is a little bit higher than we believe. But again, we couldn't tell. And the increases are in a fascinating area. They're in the people reinstating. They are not in new licenses. They are in out-of-state folks. And our renewals are sort of holding steady. So we're looking at the end of the biennium, having just slightly more than we thought we had. But if you'll also notice, our actual expenditures that we're projecting based on our accountant are just slightly less than
Representative Springer
last
has
biennium.
A question.
Oh, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And maybe you were going to get here, Vicki. So this is my third term on Ways and Means here. And you are completely other funds budget, right? So you're completely
yes.
dependent upon the licensing. So where my question's going, and I don't yet understand, I would hope that I realize the economy is a factor, but when we're talking other funds, I think that maybe stabilizes it a little bit. I'm talking about 08 and 09. How can this body support the commission in projecting out at least 2 and 3 biennium to account for some of those fluctuations? We know we cut teachers sometimes, and that's a terrible thing, and we don't like that, and 08 caught many of us off guard. But that was a bit of an anomaly. But we know we're going to have X amount of teachers. Is there a way this body can support the commission in projecting out farther to eliminate some of the real highs and real lows?
Co-chairs, Representative Springer, I don't know quite how to do that. I think I understand every aspect that brings revenue into our office, and I'll be talking about it in a minute. But the thing that we can't predict, for example, is how many new teachers universities are going to prepare. Teachers make up 59,000 of our 65,000 licenses. So our new teachers have dropped from a high of 2,800 just 5 years ago per year to at the end of the 13-14 school year, it was 1,425. University programs have been hit extremely hard, and I have more details on that. That was not foreseeable. The conventional wisdom is that when the economy is bad, people go back to school. And that actually worked for us when we had little mini drops in the economy. But what we have going on now is, I think, school districts did furloughs, and conditions, class sizes jumped. 4,000 people were laid off over the course of 4 years. And people, I think, are finding teaching to become stressful. So I think that's an element in the university's lack of ability to recruit more folks. We're seeing already an uptick, though, in our new teachers. And I think, again, as schools get funded, people are going to continue to come into the profession. The other thing that had an impact that we couldn't predict was 70% of our folks, and our folks, new, brand new teachers in the last 5 years did not get jobs because school districts didn't have money to fund. Right. This biennium, because they were, school districts were funded substantially more than they had been in the previous 5 years during the 13-15 biennium, we have seen that growth. And I think that actually is what some of what we can attribute, because school districts are recruiting out of state. People are reinstating their licenses who let them lapse because they thought they weren't going to get a job. So finding stability is fairly tough. I think that if you'll look at our actual revenue in the top, though, other than the big drop we took in 11-13, it's somewhat stable, but it doesn't, you can't really allocate for growth. So what's going to happen in 13-15 if we get that fee increase? We'll have another jump that will have to weigh us through any cash flow issues we have in the next couple biennia. So I don't have a great answer. We can't. The only thing that we can do is keep our eye on the student attendance. Student attendance dropped, and then it has gone back up. We have about 550,000 kids in school, and as that grows, need for more teachers will grow. So I can tell you that our unknowns are out-of-staters, and our more knowns are the new teachers and getting more teachers into teacher prep. Administrator preparation hasn't really been affected, but there are a teeny tiny number of our numbers. There are only about 4,300 of them. So I can't give you a great answer. Although I do believe as long as schools receive at least current service level, that the agency's revenue will stabilize.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So maybe I'm operating on an assumption that's incorrect. I have assumed that if the driving force is the number of teachers needed in the state, I assume that that would be the driving force. So whether that can be filled by enough students coming from our own colleges or out of state, that number would be static. So I've been under the assumption that because we need to license teachers from out of state, different process, but we need to bring them in and license them. So whether they come from University of Oregon or across the country, they're still being licensed. Is that a faulty assumption? And then my second point, so you can just wrap them up together and I can be done, is just like in revenue, there's no modeling that can be accessed to project out. I know we do lots of modeling and job creation all the time. Is there a way to use modeling in this application? Well, that was two somewhat separate.
Co-chairs, Representative Springer, I'll answer the last one because I don't know the answer. I don't know if there is a way to model. I do know that our licensure fluctuations are almost exactly the same as all other states in the nation who were hit by the recession. And I also know that nationally, teacher enrollment is down in every state in the nation. And so I think there are some giant grand knowns, and how they will precisely translate into our budget is an unknown. The only correlation that I can find that is predictable is that stabilized school funding has an impact of stabilizing the number of teachers and licensed educators we have. And I don't have the employment numbers about whether we have recovered the numbers that were laid off, the 4,000 or so overall educators, yet. I believe we're going to be getting close coming into this next biennium. So employment in the schools is directly relevant, I think, to the stability in our license, and that's the only predictor I know I can trust. And I know you want a really better answer than that, but I don't have a better one. I apologize.
Okay. Representative Springer, and then we're going to have to keep moving.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So thank you for addressing the last part of that. Is my assumption maybe not quite accurate that the driving force for the budget is the need for the teachers, not where what universities they come from or if there's enough universities or enough students in the universities? I mean, if we hire them from out of state or we hire from U of O, it's the same, isn't it?
Co-chairs, Representative Springer, I get your question. I think, again, the unknown is you can't predict desire to enter a career or a profession or a field whether there's a demand. And I think this is the first time that we've seen this kind of drop-off in two decades in terms of teacher prep. And, yes, there is a constant in terms of the demand and where the supply might come from. I think the thing in Oregon is that we have always had a lot of people who want to be teachers, whether there were jobs or not, and we can't predict how many people want to do that. So I think that there's always hope, and people use their licenses in other areas, like they become faculty at higher ed, and they may use their license to supervise student teachers, for example. I think I could sit down, and I'd sit down with anybody because I know all the budgets for all the time that I've been here and all the nuances, and can't predict. I would not have predicted, for example, that we would have an uptick in out-of-staters or predicted that we would have had a significant number of people reinstating their license. And I can't predict how many people, when they don't get jobs, go into another profession and never come back, which is another element because they have school loans. So I think that I think we've looked at every conceivable known and unknown to try to predict, candidly.
Thank you. Why don't you go ahead?
Okay, I will. This shows you a difference in our staffing that we've had over with limited duration and permanent duration, which is, as you'll notice, we're staffed right now at where we were a decade ago when our revenue was at $3.3 million smaller fee, same amount of licenses. On slide five, I gave you a fixed paper slide, the slide that I have. Which I don't have a copy of. Thanks, Lisa. So I do have a copy of, I apologize. The difference between this slide and the slide that you have is the numbers in 1113 actually were incorrect, and they aren't 7,700, and we changed the renewals were up significantly over the course of, by about 700. The new in-state licenses last biennium were about 4,700, and we've had a little bit of a dip this biennium. The new out-of-state licenses are going to be up slightly. The new in-states are down, as we predicted. Charter schools are static. Fingerprints is an indicator to us about the number, an increase in new teachers, because we fingerprint people when they go into teacher prep. And the fact that they're up by about 700 is fairly significant and shows that it looks like our programs are rebounding a little bit more significantly than we had hoped, a little bit more carefully. But again, those are the factors that we try to pay attention to. So our applications are up, which is going to net us a few hundred thousand more in revenue. And this is a little bit about what I've been talking about. So during our February hearing, Representative Smith Warner asked us why we weren't spending some of the money in our ending fund balance, which, again, you can only spend within your limitation. But it did allow me to look at our budget with some slightly new eyes. And when we got our projections in March, it showed that we were underspending our limitation. Part of it had to do with not filling vacancies early in the biennium because of fear of what was going to happen with revenue. The second part had to do with just unexpected turnover, which created some gap in our revenue. So I'll just be candid. We've taken advantage of that revenue limitation gap to hire some temporary staff and do some pay some overtime and do some staff rearranging to show you what would happen if we were able to staff up to actually have the evidence to show Representative Huffman that we can get results. So these are the improvements that we've been able to accomplish since our February hearing. When I came in to see you, we had 1,800 pending email, and some of them were out for a few months. By paying overtime alone, and we got those down to 86 when we did the slide. On Friday morning, they were down to zero. On Sunday, we had somebody come in and work overtime and again took them down to number one. And to show you what came in between Sunday noon and this morning, when I left the office, we had 65 pending emails. So even over a weekend day when you think people are out with Jared drinking beer and having hot dogs, they're emailing our office. The average email we get over the course of a day during a regular sort of work day is about 80 to 100. So by paying overtime and working just a couple hours every day on this, we have actually caught up the email 100%. The most exciting thing, I think, is that our licensure director did some staffing realignment and got some very dramatic results. So if you'll notice, up to March 4th, the number of calls that came in that we were able to handle, and I know I heard from you, and it was hard, and it has been hard, was not even 40%. The average talk time, as you can see, remains about the same, but our speed of answering depends on whether we can have one person on the phone or one and a half people on the phone, was half an hour delays. So about 60% average, a little bit more, of those calls are being abandoned. We now have two people full-time on the phones from 7:30 to 5:30 using overtime and also having the ability to fill a vacancy during that time with an experienced public service representative who'd worked with us before. And we flip-flopped the percentages. just in that short amount of time. So if you'll notice that the average time that people are abandoning calls is a little bit shorter, but the speed of answering the calls is 5 to 4 minutes average. It just depends on the day. This is something we can track with significant detail. And we're hearing already from folks who are so surprised and delighted, obviously, when they get an answer. So our hope is we've shown that if we can staff the way we need to staff, because we've hired some temp workers and limited duration people to back up for the summer so that we don't have to take a drop during the summer. With a current service level budget and no fee increase, we would have to lay those folks off at November 1st or about November 15th maybe. But the point is that we know now by staffing the way that we were staffed prior to this biennium that we can make a difference. The other thing that we were doing in 2011 and we were unable to do in 2012 is we had Saturdays open. So we, during the summer in 2011, we were open in the morning on Saturday from about 8 o'clock to noon to answer the phones and take walk-ins. We found, we also kept the phones open 7:30 to 5:30 like we are now. We tried 7 to 6, but there's almost no calls between 7 and 7:30 and 5:30 and 6. So we found the nugget time when people are going to call. So our hope is we've asked for a position on the phones and the emails to train up for the next biennium that we can have a Saturday time open as well as continue the phone coverage. The current director of licensure has also figured out that the phone people need to be off and away from the front desk, and that the folks sitting at the front desk should be taking walk-ins, which our highest volume is during the summer, and answering email, and then the phones are going on in the back. That means we need to have four people, two people on the phones in the back, two people on the front doing email and walk-ins. And that requires at least one more position for us. We have three public service representatives. The licensure backlog, it says value. That's interesting. Well, does yours say value? I apologize. So it's 19 at the top and 11.5 at the bottom. And so in the 3 months, by reorganizing staff and paying overtime, and also sort of picking off the complete applications, we have been able to reduce that backlog down to 11 and a half weeks. Like to sustain that and get it down, because when we were here in, when we were starting, ending the 2013 biennium, we were at 20 days turnaround. We know we can get there again, and we asked for another position here. That's so fascinating, and I apologize. That number is 164. This is just up till now. So the commission's had two meetings. We have a meeting coming up in June. These are known investigations. We've already done about 120, and we have 40 to 50 going to the next commission meeting. We have a November meeting scheduled, so we're going to get very close back up to the 236 number for this year in terms of completed investigations. That 132 is the result of some unexpected turnover. We had a veteran investigator get married and move out of state, and we hired a new investigator who was unexpectedly deployed to Afghanistan. And so then we had to hire someone else to come in and backfill for the short, what we thought then was the short amount of time, which ended up being almost a year for him. I know he wanted to be home sooner. He came back in May, on May 18th, and we had to reopen a hiring to for a limited duration investigator so that we could have an additional investigator. This is, again, where we're spending some of our limitation. So now we have four investigators actively doing investigations on staff, and expect those numbers to get back up in the 280s, 278 over the course of the biennium if we can sustain keeping that extra limited duration investigator. So I just want to remind you that we're going live with an online system. It's contracted to open November 2015. I know that there's superstition with those folks who work on those systems about being thinking it'll open earlier, but I know they think it will open earlier, but that's the contracted date, which they're completely confident they're going to meet. This will make a huge difference. We currently have two people opening mail every single day, and that time averages an hour and a half to 2 hours. Two people that we have to tie up, take them off the phones or take them off of issuing licenses or some other area. My director of licensure has been one of those people for the last 6 months just to keep someone in issuing licenses or answering the phone. I took pictures. I didn't put them on here, but that means all that money I showed you, the $4.6 million or $5.1 million, is touched by human hands when it comes in our office by way of a check. So this system will allow us to, people can pay online, they can upload their applications, and they can, it's just going to eliminate a significant amount of that manual processing.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Very brief question. Are you going to eliminate the paper option? Are we moving to only online? Or phase in? What are you thinking?
So, co-chairs, Representative Smith Warner, if I had my way, I'd say Hawaii did that. And I think over the course of the biennium, we're going to phase it in. I think that you can only do so much and be dramatic, and we want to see how it's working. We'll get it out there. We have a significant amount of people who are dying to do this. I'm going to play it by ear. My goal, I would love to say no more right now, but I think the goal would be to say all applications must be online in 2 years.
But that has not yet been established.
Correct.
Thank you.
Mr. Wilson.
Mr. Chair, members, I think we still have a number of slides to go through, and if Ms. Chamberlain's available tomorrow morning, we could carry over this bill and make sure that there's time spent on some of the policy packages. Our hope is that we can work session this early next week. So are you available tomorrow morning?
Yes. Although I believe I can get through these.
Well, you still have, 30 or 20 plus slides, so I don't want to. You got about 3 or 4 minutes, so.
Yeah, and we need to talk as a subcommittee briefly too. Okay. So, why don't we take this time then to set over,
carry over
5538 until tomorrow, and thank you, Ms. Chamberlain. We'll see you tomorrow. And subcommittee, I have some homework for you. I need you to, and if you need help from Mr. Wilson to provide that, I need you to let me know if there are bills that have been submitted to Ways and Means that are likely to come to education, if they come anywhere at all, that are your priorities. I'd like to know if you have bills that you would like the co-chair and I to lobby for, and I would also like to know if you have spending priorities, budget priorities on issues pertaining to education, pertaining to those bills, or just to the overall budget that are a high priority for you. We need this information within, say, a week, by sometime next week, so that Madam Co-Chair and I can go and lobby the big co-chairs and try and put together a total budget and a package of bills that this subcommittee supports and sees as a priority. Also, I'm going to need to know, after we finish with TSBC tomorrow, if you have concerns about the proposal that is before that the co-chair and I have discussed. What the proposal is to go ahead and give Ms. Chamberlain the additional tools that she needs, the additional staffing, and that means fee increases. And then we've already passed a measure that will lead to an audit of this agency before next February. We'll have that audit, and then we can look at this agency again come next February, February 16, and determine whether or not the additional tools that we have granted this agency has allowed this agency to improve its performance, shall we say, to the degree that we're comfortable. I hear from a lot of legislators and a lot of educators that are cranky right now about the way TSPC has performed. And so my plan, and Madam Co-Chair's plan, is to give them the additional resources and then check and see through an audit, Secretary of State's audit, that we've already approved, and then make decisions come next February for, well, I guess all of us will be back next February. So that's the plan, and I need to know if any of you are uncomfortable with that plan, and Madam, you can either tell me or tell Betty, and so that if necessary, we can make alterations in that plan. But I wanted this subcommittee to understand the direction that your co-chairs think we ought to go. Yes, Senator Roland.
Mr. Wilson, is there a place in the full Ways and Means history where we can find education bills that are in full Ways and Means that haven't been assigned any place yet?
I will try to put together a list because the co-chairs asked for the same thing this morning. Okay. I'll work on that today. It may be tomorrow by the time I get it out to folks.
Okay, that's perfect.
The full committee has
hundreds,
probably 200 plus bills.
Right, that's what I was
in its possession.
Representative Huffman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Has the Secretary of State committed to get the audit done in that amount of time then already? Or we've just asked.
Yes. Basically, we instruct the Secretary of State to do the audit and to have it to us before next February, and the Secretary of State, I'm sure, will accomplish that task.
Oh.
Senator Roblin.
They have told me, Secretary of State's office has told me, that there are two audits that they are committed to getting done. One of them is this one. There's another education audit that they're also committed to.
Okay. Anything else? Madam Co-Chair?
No, you covered it all.
Okay. Thank you very much. Hope you had a nice long holiday.
That's right.
Because we have a lot of work to do in the next month. And we'll see you all tomorrow morning, and we're adjourned. And we're adjourned.